It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you watch science fiction in the movies, the future might look pretty bleak with a whole lot of dystopia out there. But our guest authors are trying to use science fiction as a source for inspiration and optimism.
First, yesterday New York City saw what is reported to have been the world's largest ever climate march, with over 400,000 people streaming down New York's 6th Avenue for the People's Climate March. The march was aimed at demonstrating public concern for the climate going into the UN Climate Summit, which begins tomorrow.
All 50 states were represented at the march, including a group of Wisconsinites organized by the environmental group 350 Madison.
One of the organizers of that group is here with us now, along with a local high school student. Laura Schlachter is a co-coordinator with Madison 350, and Laura Kiernan is a student at Madison's West High School. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this is reported to have been the world's largest ever climate march. At first, there were numbers coming out saying 310,000, and then the latest reports were 400,000. Can you describe, Laura, that feeling of being there with so many people yesterday?
It's a really incredible feeling to know that you're not only joined by 400,000 other people on the streets of New York, but also with people in 166 countries all around the world. So we were marching in solidarity with over 2,800 other actions. And as we were going down the street in New York, there was a huge jumbotron with shots from all around the world. So it's a pretty moving experience.
And Laura, I'm going to ask you next, can you just describe the scene? What was it like?
There were so many people there. I mean, from my point in the back of the march, I could see as if the march went infinitely one direction. I couldn't even see the end of it. And it, again, what Laura said, it felt so great to be a part of history in the making.
And you're a student at West High School in Madison. Can you give me a sense of the age ranges? Did you see a lot of other, you know, young people there? And what was just the range of the people that were marching?
Oh, definitely. There was a ton of young people there, as well as older people. I mean, in our own bus, we had age ranges from 3 years old to 70 years old. So this is an issue that spreads across generations.
Now, Laura, I want to ask you, how many people from Wisconsin went?
Mm-hmm. So 350 Madison, along with the John Muir chapter of the Sierra Club, organized three buses that sent over 150 people. And then we also had Wisconsinites who met us in New York, who had traveled on the People's Climate Train and by other means. So we had about 200 people from our great state of Wisconsin.
Now, I'm sure everyone had similar reasons from being there, but maybe also more personal ones. Do you want to share yours?
Yeah, I got involved with 350 Madison because I had spent so many years reading the news about climate change and feeling like there was nothing I could do. I was just one person. And when I started getting involved, I realized that actually there's a lot we can do when we work together. And so for me, participating in the People's Climate March was a chance to, like Laura said, be part of history, but also raise up our collective voices and magnify the impact that any one of us could have on our own.
And Laura, you are, again, a high schooler, so you're the next generation coming up and inhabiting this planet. You want to talk a little bit about why you decided to go and make this giant trek to be there?
Yeah, well, when I was a little kid, I thought of global warming as, you know, save the polar bears, the ice is melting. But I've realized now that it's so much more than that. It has health, economic, social, class, and environmental issues all into one great issue. So I would just want to be a part of the change.
Was there a turning point for you when you decided that this was something you were going to care enough about to get involved in?
Well, I think that my mom is a big influence in my life. She's part of 350, and she's helped me to see that living a healthier and more environmental lifestyle is better for the planet.
In terms of the overall message of the march, how would you describe it?
Well, we wanted to tell our global leaders a couple of things. One is that we need meaningful action on climate change now. We have this UN Climate Summit coming up on Tuesday, and we wanted our global leaders to know that they have our support in doing the right thing. Secondly, a big message of the march is to change everything. We need everyone. And it was so inspiring of me really to see the coming of age of the climate movement, for us to recognize that the moral, economic, and ecological crises facing our globe are really interconnected.
And in terms of what the United States has done so far, what kind of report card would you give our country?
I think we have a long way to go.
What would you like to see change specifically?
So I really, in the state of Wisconsin, we've actually really become a battlefield in the fight for climate justice. So specifically in our state, I would like to see President Obama reject the presidential permits for tar sands pipelines from Alberta that are basically using Wisconsin, Minnesota, and other states in the upper Midwest as a flyover zone for very dangerous tar sands oil. And so, you know, President Obama and other global leaders have a critical role to play, not only in stopping an extractive fossil fuel industry, but also in investing in clean energy.
Do you think that seeing 400,000 people in New York yesterday, people around the world, will have any kind of impact at the UN Climate Summit?
I certainly think so. I mean, today we heard an announcement that the Rockefeller Foundation, which was founded on the fossil fuel extraction, that they are now divesting from fossil fuels and joining a global divestment movement of some real movers and shakers in the global economy. So I think we're already seeing a huge impact from the climate march, and I'm looking forward to seeing it take the next step at the political level.
How significant would you say a decision like that is, of the divestment from oil money toward a cleaner source of energy?
I think it's absolutely crucial.
In terms of Wisconsin here, let's zoom in on our state in particular. What do you think of the state of the environment here in Wisconsin and how we're doing addressing climate change as a state?
Again, I think that Wisconsin has a long way to go. And going back to the tar sands issue, one of the things that 350 Madison has really pushed for and, in fact, worked very closely with the Madison Board of Supervisors, recently passed a resolution calling on the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to conduct a full environmental impact statement on Enbridge Line 61. So I think that's one of many ways that we can continue to promote a clean energy policy and create clean jobs in the state.
And Laura, we'll end with you. What would you like to tell the next generation, maybe people who weren't involved, about what you learned and what your hopes are?
Well, I would like to tell them that climate change is an issue now. It's not something that we can see in the future. There are major consequences of our actions that are affecting people now, and that's why we need a change.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Laura Schlachter, co-coordinator for the climate group 350 Madison, and Laura Kiernan, student at Madison West High School. They attended the People's Climate March in New York City yesterday, and it was reported to be the world's largest ever climate march.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in our Wisconsin Life segment, we'll learn about what it's like to be an arborist. Then we'll talk about a new statewide initiative to spark conversations about the meaning of work.
First, science fiction has been big in theaters in recent years, but for the most part, the big movies have painted a really bleak picture. Think of the dark futures of The Hunger Games and Insurgent. And there's been a strong dystopian element in print, too, in young adult science fiction and beyond.
Our next guests are part of an effort to shake things up and to use science fiction as an inspiration, a way to create visions for brighter futures with an optimistic view of the potential of technology.
That effort is called Project Hieroglyph, and it's based at Arizona State University. Catherine Kramer is with us. She's a writer and editor, and she's co-editor of the new book, Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we have one of the contributors to that book with us. Gregory Benford is a Nebula Award-winning science fiction writer. He's also a professor of physics at the University of California, Irvine. He joins us from the studios of KUCI in Irvine. Gregory, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Hello there.
So, Catherine, was it a fair assessment? Science fiction has a lot of dark futures, not as much in the way of inspiration these days?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a fashion for dystopias. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of dystopias, and some of them are more productive than others. I think what Neal Stephenson was getting at when he raised the subject of dystopias is, you know, dystopianism is an attitude where nothing can be solved, and so we go about having bleak adventures. And that's fairly common in the movies, and that's certainly fashionable, particularly in young adult literature these days.
And Gregory, looking at a lot of the technological advances of the last few decades, do you think science fiction helped pave the way?
Well, surely, if you count the space program, mid-20th century science fiction was almost totally dominated by visions of how we'll carry out the exploration of the solar system. And later on, even now, we're talking about how it can work economically.
And did it work in part? I know I've heard that science fiction maybe inspired people to go into sciences and engineering and things like that. But did it also just change the way we think and change the way we imagine our future?
Exactly. Nobody's going to buy a robot, even a little Roomba that clears the house, unless they've actually heard of them before. It's part of a general rule that you cannot have a future that you don't first imagine.
And Catherine, in the introduction to the book, you mentioned things like the Great Pyramids and the Hoover Dam and things like that that wouldn't have gotten started without that imagination. Are you hoping that Project Hieroglyph will pave the way toward future wonders that we may not be able to imagine yet?
Well, I think it's worth a try. I think people may not necessarily build things that are in the book, mm-hmm. but we are trying to get people to think in a particular direction.
And Catherine,
about problems as things we can solve. And in Neil's point that he was making in his initial essay was that a lot of the infrastructure that we're living with now is from decades ago. And I think that one of the underlying themes of the book is creating new infrastructures.
And are we forward-thinking like we used to be? When we built those infrastructures we're walking on, driving on, using the Internet on now, were we more forward-thinking then than we are now?
I think that's true. I think that in general there was a kind of a vision of the future as something that, you know, was shiny and new and could be built, and I think we're much more cynical about it. This is not to say that great stuff has not been done. I mean, the Human Genome Project recently, you know, will make amazing changes, but there are, you know, in terms of the infrastructure of our daily lives, with a lot of it is older technology that has not changed in a long time.
And Gregory, you've written a number of novels over the years, as well as your contribution to the book Hieroglyph. When you're writing as a science fiction author, do you have these ideas in mind that in addition to telling a story and creating a world, you are trying to inspire or boost our imagination?
Yes, exactly. I like the act of imagining because the world is full of possibilities, but we largely ignore them. And that's never a good idea in the long run because, as Catherine remarked, if you build new infrastructure, there are always people who will find new uses for it.
And Catherine, for this project and this book in particular, were you aiming for things just on the horizon or way distant futures? Are we talking about galaxies far, far away or the next two or three decades?
Well, we were trying for the next two or three decades. You know, you work with a bunch of writers, you're herding cats, so not everything is in the next few decades. But it's near future rather than far future. The general intention of the book was to come up with things that scientists and engineers could get some traction on and start working on in this generation rather than, you know, saying, well, gee, 30 years from now this might be something we could work on. It was intended to be something that would inspire people to do work now.
And Greg, you're one of those cats she was herding. Let's get into some specific technology. In your story, it centers around asteroid mining. How close is that to being a reality?
Well, there's a company already pursuing it, Interplanetary Resources. But actually, that's not the first thing that happens in the book. In the first several applications are things like really getting good robotics in space so you can build things in low Earth orbit, or just slightly beyond that, realizing that there are several hundred billion dollars worth of dead assets in geosynchronous satellite orbit. These satellites have many of them single point failures, or their solar panels have run down. If you have robots, you can go there and do maintenance on them and bring them back to life, and that's recovering a lost asset. And that's a real business model. I thought of it, in fact, when I was writing the story.
So we're close to that step on, or are we starting to put that into practice, robots that repair those slightly failed assets for new uses?
I've talked to people who've looked at this, and they say on a scale of 10 to 20 years, yes, we could definitely do that. We need more reliable transport to geosynchronous orbit, which probably means we should start using nuclear thermal rockets out of low Earth orbit and into higher orbit because they're much more efficient.
And another point of your story, I think, is a lot of our space program so far has been to make things as foolproof as possible, not going into it with as much a spirit of risk-taking as possible. You're hoping to turn the corner on that, I think.
Right. I mean, I think it was a fundamental mistake for NASA to try to take the drama, i.e. the risk, out of space. I think knowing that things are risky makes them more interesting. You know, the Western is a whole genre that was developed not because the West was safe, but because it was so dangerous.
And Catherine, what are some of the other technologies, including these space repair robots and asteroid mining? What are some others you might highlight in the new collection?
Well, Madeline Ashby, for example, came up with ideas for technologies about how our borders might work very differently, sort of gamifying border crossings so that highly qualified people were the ones who were allowed to immigrate, for example. Carl Schroeder has a concept for a technology that would change the way political decision-making works. And it's something that would seem to me like one of the ideas most likely to work that's in the whole book. From his point of view, we have a lot of the technologies we already need, and that a lot of our problems are political in terms of getting the power structure to apply those properly. And so his focus was on how to change that, which I think is quite fascinating.
I think I've seen you, Catherine, comment that some of the technologies in the book, reality is catching up with even as the book is being published. I think in part 3D printing on the moon was one of those.
Yeah, we had multiple writers getting in touch with us after they'd turned their stories in saying, I need to change my story because this piece of it just came true. And that is the hazard of writing near future science fiction, in that you know, you think you're ahead of the game, but you know, you may not be.
Gregory, how often has this happened to you? You've written novels set in the recent near term, I think, where, you know, the U.S.-Soviet Union rivalry, for example, plays a major role in it. Does it disappoint you when history catches up and takes things in a different direction?
Well, remember, Russia currently is just mostly run the same way the USSR was. They've just changed the label. But my history of bumping up against the future, it goes all the way back to the late 60s when I published a story describing the first computer virus. In fact, I wrote the first computer virus on the DARPA net in 1969. But the point is, I described this, and no one really thought it would ever be a threat because they couldn't see any motive to do it.
Whoops. So
yep.
We're ahead of the curve there. Catherine, how much of the role of science fiction is predicting the future, and how much of it is, I guess, making us interrogate the future and think about it and how it affects our lives in the present?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that one can predict or point to that science fiction predicted. If you go item by item through the things that were projected by science fiction, we don't have a very good track record. There's many more things that did not come true. But if you think of it in terms of, you know, inspiration and getting people, getting people to think about the future in a problem-solving way and in an extrapolative way, science fiction's had a huge impact, and that's what we're trying to highlight with this book. This is about getting people moving, not, you know, telling you what the future is.
And Gregory, I think a lot of people might think science fiction and get the trappings of the spaceships and the high technology. How much of it is predicting the future of humanity, how we act, our laws, how we behave?
Well, that's always the goal, is you introduce a new technology and you see how it changes the human prospect. We science fiction writers are mostly concerned about expanding human horizons. And over the horizon lies new kinds of ways of behaving. We're extremely different from the people of only 200 years ago, for example, in many of our attitudes, but also our capabilities. I mean, I have a left shoulder that I broke surfing, which is repaired and functional, and that would never have happened. And without it, I would have been an invalid most of my life.
We're talking to author Gregory Bedford and editor Catherine Kramer. They're both involved with Project Hieroglyph and the new book, Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future.
And you can join the conversation. Do you think science fiction can be an inspiration for technology and other innovations? Is there a science fiction book, movie, or TV show that you think provides an inspiring vision for the future? And do you feel like there's been a glut of bad news in science fiction and movies and elsewhere? Lots of dystopias with little positive side. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with science fiction author Gregory Bedford and editor Catherine Kramer. They're part of Project Hieroglyph, an effort to create positive visions of our technological future. The new book is from the book Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Is there a science fiction book, movie, or TV show that inspires you, that inspires a vision of future and the way we interact with technology? Is there a technology that you think is on the horizon that's going to change the way we live on this planet or beyond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Mike on the line now in Franklin. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. No, I just wanted to say that I actually respect both your authors greatly. I enjoy their work. I disagree with the premise that that we need to have more optimistic versions of the future represented in literature. In my mind, I've been reading science fiction since I was probably 10 or 11 years old. I'm 47 and probably read, I don't know, maybe 1,000 or so works. And it seems like the body of science fiction that I've read is fairly evenly distributed between dystopian and utopian, and it's sort of independent of when it was written. It seems like there's plenty of examples of authors that have fantastic visions of the future that are currently writing, and I would say that was true of the past as well, and there's dystopian versions of the future that were written 35, 40 years ago or longer, and that there were utopian versions written then as well.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Gregory Bedford, I'm guessing you wouldn't argue with a lot of what he had to say, but do you think there's enough of what you're doing in Project Hieroglyph of the near-term technological optimism in the science fiction world?
Yes, there's a great deal. And I agree with the caller. Utopian positive science fiction tells you things you maybe you should do. Dystopian tells you maybe things you shouldn't do, and therefore they're sides of the same coin. But the main point is to get people to think about the future and realize it can be different.
And Catherine, you've worked not just in this project, but lots of other volumes you've edited with a lot of authors. Do you think there are, can you give us a couple names of authors operating in this near-term vision that you're looking for here that you could point us toward for further reading?
Well, I mean, Kim Stanley Robinson is somebody who came into the science fiction field doing pretty much this sort of thing and has been doing it ever since. A lot of the hard science fiction writers tend to have a kind of positive, optimistic vision. What I think Neal Stephenson felt was lacking was particularly the sort of thing aimed at infrastructure. And I think that the generalized attack on dystopianism as such is a bit too vague, and that there's a lot of different ways things can be, you know, upbeat versus downbeat, having happy endings, having likable characters, et cetera. And I think he really meant something very specific having to do with whether it inspired us to innovate in infrastructure.
Mike, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Mike in Eau Claire. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was going to talk about Dune. It's far into the future, and humanity colonized the entire universe, you know, thanks to that wonder drug, the spice, that gives people the ability to build a, you know, fold space and everything. And as a result, then you have all these separate planets with separate governments, and they basically just ditch democracy, and it's run by a, you know, like a feudal society, you know, right?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. So Dune, as he said, Gregory, it's pointing to the distant future, but some fears that I know some people feel in the near term, too.
Well, indeed. Let's point out that some of the major societies on the planet, like China, are basically not democracies. They are authoritarian in an extreme way. So that's a kind of bleak vision of the future, I think. But it's common. Yes.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Catherine, wanted to talk about Project Hieroglyph beyond the book. I know that it works not just with science fiction authors, but with researchers and professors in various fields of science and technology. How do you bring together, how are the authors and these researchers brought together to try to make the ideas a little closer to reality?
Well, first, you should understand that this project is sort of a special project that was put in motion by the president of Arizona State University. So we have a completely unprecedented situation where not only is it possible for scientists to participate in this in a science fiction project, but they're getting active support and encouragement from the top of the university administration. Now, the person who put them in contact, our writers, in contact with the scientists and engineers is my collaborator, Ed Finn. I mean, he has the Center for Science and the Imagination at Arizona State University, and they had sort of would find out what the needs were from the authors and do a certain amount of matchmaking between authors and scientists. But we'd really like to do this sort of thing on a much larger scale, involving more disciplines, more visual things, and also works that reach a much broader audience.
Gregory, it seems like a challenge in this near-term science fiction we're talking about is the sense of maintaining a sense of wonder. And what I mean by that is, if you explained the internet to somebody 30, 40 years ago, they would have thought, wow, what a science fiction concept, or how implausible that is. And now we order our groceries on it and, you know, send notes to grandma on it. We take it for granted now. How do we take this gosh wow stuff that's in the near term and keep being excited about it as it starts to become a reality?
Well, it's worth remarking that, yeah, a lot of people like me 40 years ago could see the internet coming, but what we didn't see coming was Facebook. So it's the social evolution that really gives you the biggest surprises, because people are so endlessly innovative and very social. So I think, yes, that's the tough part of science fiction, is looking at the second order effect. I mean, lots of writers like H.G. Wells foresaw the influence of the automobile. What they couldn't predict was the drive-in movie theater or backseat sex.
And Catherine, in the Hieroglyph book, do the authors take the infrastructural ideas that they look at and try to figure out then how humans are going to interact with them? I know Gregory did with the technology that he talks about. What are some of the other examples of how society reacts to these near-term technological changes?
Well, Brenda Cooper's story takes the idea, you know, the current day technology of drones and extrapolates it as something that could be used to prevent poachers from driving animals extinct in Africa. Whereas Lee Constantinou has a completely different use of drones in his story. It's a sort of counterculture effort to keep the internet safe from governmental domination, where all the little wireless routers are in these cute little drones flying all over the place. So, we take one basic technology, which is essentially a military technology right now, and we see several very different social extrapolations from it.
Catherine, what's the next step after a Hieroglyph? What do you want to take Project Hieroglyph to as your part of it, from science fiction authors and others?
Well, I mean, we're going in a couple of different directions. There's a project that I'm also involved with, which is called Evoke, which is a combination online graphic novel and game thing in collaboration with the World Bank. And, of course, we'd also like to do more volumes of hieroglyphs, but we'd also like to expand into other media like film and television. So those are we want to go further with this. We feel this is just the beginning rather than the end of the project.
And Gregory, as we wrap up, what would you like to see from the science fiction writers of the future?
I'd like to see more innovative ideas and particularly look at even the ideas that are in this first volume of Hieroglyph and take them further and see what they'll do. Here's an example. I realized after looking at Neal Stephenson's 20-kilometer tall tower idea that the potential difference between the head and the foot is over 2.5 megawatts. And if you do the calculation, you find out you can power the entire American Southwest with free energy gotten this way, a completely new way to get energy out of the world.
Gregory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Catherine, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We've been hearing from Gregory Benford, Nebula Award-winning science fiction author, and Catherine Kramer, writer and editor for Project Hieroglyph. They've been talking about the new book, Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more American adults are single than married now, but why? An expert on marriage and family life looks at the story behind the long-term transition.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Climbing trees is a childhood pastime, but for arborists, scaling trees to keep them healthy is a serious pursuit. Seth Jovog brings us this story from Dane County.
The hardest part about learning to climb is to trust your system. All of the ropes and all of the equipment and gear that you use is completely overrated for a reason, because they know your life is going to depend on it. I can almost guarantee you the tree will fail before your gear does. So you have to trust your rope.
Stand clear.
My name is Shelley Wollerman, and I am a certified arborist for Stephen R. Bassett Incorporated. I grew up in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, in the country, grew up on a dairy farm. I knew I liked to be outdoors, and I knew I couldn't have a desk job. It's not who I am. When I turned 16 and got my driver's license, my mom basically told me that I had to get a real job. And I was like, okay, what are my options? And there's actually a family at our church that we went to who had a landscaping business. I was like, well, I'll give that a try, see how it goes. I moved in March of 2009, Fitchburg, where I live now, actually. So I actually moved for the job. And later that fall, there are two main tree guys who are actually moving out of state. And I had always kind of wanted to learn how to try it, but I really never had the opportunity to do it. I really didn't know anything about it. So they stuck me on the tree crew for a day, and they're like, so you want to learn? And I'm like, sure, why not, you know? You're just usually freaking out your first time, because I know I was 15 feet off the ground and I'm like, what the hell am I doing, you know? It took me a long time to get used to using a chainsaw on a tree. I think I went a year without, I was like, nope, I'll handsaw through that, I don't care. I didn't want to use a chainsaw, I was scared of it.
This is a 550, Husky 550. It's a nice little medium-sized ground saw. It's light enough, but it's got the power to cut through bigger stuff, so.
I thought I was in shape when I came into the job, you know, just because when I first started, I actually specifically went to the gym to weightlift. They kept telling me it's a lot of upper body strength, and I'm like, okay, so I weightlifted. And then I got into a tree, and I was so sore the next day. I mean, you use completely different muscles than you would doing anything else, really. I mean, you can't really train for it. You do kind of just destroy your body climbing trees. I mean, it's not easy. I think being a certified arborist, you kind of have to be a little bit different of a person. I think we are a little bit all crazy, because, I mean, you kind of have to have the job that we have. It's a really satisfying job. I mean, if you show up to a really thick honey locust or ash tree or silver maple and you do a good prune on it, it looks nice. You can tell when you get done that what you did really helped the health of this tree.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council and its Working Lives Project, where you can hear more from Wisconsin's working people.
Dina Wartzel joins us now to tell us more about the Working Lives Project. She's the executive director of the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Dina, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Rob. Happy to be here.
Well, what is the Working Lives Project?
Well, the segment that we just heard on Wisconsin Life is a perfect example of what the Working Lives Project is all about. Let me start this way. When I was a kid, I lived in Prague for a number of years. And one of my most vivid memories is of a small, very elderly woman walking down the street every evening carrying a long pole with a hook on the end. And that woman with her pole was why the city streets there were lit, because in the 1970s, many parts of the center of Prague were still lit with gas lamps. When I went back to Prague years later, the gas lamps had been replaced by electric streetlights, and that job of lamplighter no longer existed. I actually recently learned that gas lamps are being brought back to the city, which is now more interested in its past, and that old woman's job is reportedly being done by men clad in 19th century attire. So what may sound like a funny story about a peculiar job, I think actually illustrates something universal about work, that every job is part of a web of connections, connections to the past, to changing cultural values, changing technology, pole versus and gas versus electricity, to economics, to the public policy that made a city decide that they would bring this old technology back. And that story, I think, also speaks to the fact that a lot of what we depend upon in our lives is the product of unseen labor done by people who we probably will never meet. Once the woman with her pole is gone, it's easier to forget about the people who keep the lights on, unless, of course, you happen to be one of them, or unless you develop that awareness of others' work as part of your worldview. And that's very much what the project is about, is developing that awareness of others' work.
So it sounds like there's kind of an untold story behind any job.
Mm-hmm, exactly, and that's precisely what that wonderful story about the arborist was about, because how many of us, many of us have climbed trees, but how many of us have thought about what it takes to keep a tree healthy and how human beings can participate in that, right?
Mm-hmm. So how are you defining work for this project? Is it just, a place where you go and clock in and get paid?
No, we're defining work a lot more broadly. Of course, as we've all heard, jobs narrowly defined or their lack are a really hot topic in the governor's race. And of course, we're thinking about work in that sense. The effects of the recession are still being felt. The future of work is uncertain in many ways for all of us. But we feel like there's a need to deepen and broaden the conversation about work. So the purpose of the Working Lives Project is to go beyond that very limited political discussion about jobs and have a larger conversation about what the actual experience is of how each of us makes a living and makes a life, and how that connects us to each other. Studs Terkel, who we quote on the homepage of this project on our website, said something that sort of captures it. He said, "Work is a search for daily meaning as well as daily bread." And certainly that search for daily meaning can happen through paid employment, but also through the unpaid effort that we put into the things that we care about. So for us, work is about those things that provide meaning as well as sustenance.
So what kind of stories are you going out there and trying to collect?
Well, as many as people want to think about in terms of work, we've just kicked off the project on Labor Day, but we can look back to things that the Humanities Council has done in recent years related to work, I think, to find some wonderful examples. Obviously, all of the Wisconsin Life stories that you've been airing are great examples, but some other ones that have been done by organizations around the state that we know about through our grant program include, for example, a play that was written and produced about the life story of Lavinia Goodell, someone someone that many of us may not have heard of. Goodell was the first female lawyer in Wisconsin who had to fight in the 1870s to be allowed to argue before the state Supreme Court at a time when women had not been fully accepted into the legal profession. Another story from a recent exhibit was, actually a collection of stories about people who are reviving traditional skills such as papermaking and knife carving. What I love about that exhibit was that it encouraged visitors to think about how these current-day traditional craftspeople are motivated by their interest in creating not just beautiful objects, but also participating in new kinds of local communities and economies, again, sort of reflecting upon work, but also how the ways we work connect us to one another. So making those connections between work and life and economy and community and the choices that people make in their lives.
As we listen to these radio pieces or go see the play or the other things that are happening here, what are you hoping changes in the way we think and talk about work?
Well, I certainly think that the most important thing for us is that people develop a kind of empathy and understanding about one another. And I think, again, this takes us back to the role of the humanities in developing, as we talk about it, wisdom in citizens. This was part of the reason that the Humanities Council was founded over 40 years ago by the National Endowment for the Humanities. In the founding legislation, it talked about developing wisdom in citizens. So really what we're hoping is that we can, through these experiences and development of empathy for people who do all kinds of work, that we can help citizens better participate wisely in those conversations.
So instead of going through our day thinking a store clerk, parking attendant, janitor, we think person, and try to connect with them on that level?
Mm-hmm, exactly. I mean, as you say, we aren't all, pipe fitters or computer programmers. We aren't all business people or public servants. Not everyone's a volunteer firefighter. Not everyone's a stay-at-home parent. People, don't live having all the same challenges, all the same opportunities, or all the same beliefs or the same dreams. But what we think is that we can learn from everyone's life. We can celebrate the life and work of every person, however they define that work. And hopefully if we do, then we'll have a better shot at making life in Wisconsin, rich for everyone, both in community connections and in individual meaning, and of course, materially as well.
There might be somebody out there thinking, hey, I got a story to tell about my job. Do you want volunteers? Do you want people to contact you and offer to share their stories?
We absolutely do. And there are a number of ways that we would encourage people to do that. But, certainly I hope people will come to the Wisconsin Humanities Council's website and take a look at the Working Lives Project, read those stories. You can, we definitely are looking for more stories. Contact us, through Twitter or Facebook. But, please, come to our staff page and write to me directly and let me know what your stories are and what your ideas are. The project is very much in formation. We've been partnering with a lot of different people and organizations around the state and certainly are looking through our grant program to fund programs all over the state that people develop from their own interests and their own ideas in their communities.
Dina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob. This has been wonderful.
That was Dina Wartzel. She's Executive Director of the Wisconsin Humanities Council. She was with us to talk about the Working Lives Project, an initiative to jumpstart the conversation about work around Wisconsin.